Welcome to the Leadership Journey Podcast. I'm Alan Wilson, the host of the podcast. A few days ago, I spoke at a men's breakfast that was run by Westlake Church in Lausanne, Switzerland. It's a church that I was involved with in its early development almost 15 years ago. I spoke from the story of Moses with an overview of some of the elements of his leadership journey. In the famous words of D.L. Moody, Moses spent 40 years thinking he was somebody, 40 years learning he was nobody, and 40 years discovering what God can do with a nobody. Instead of an interview with a leader, this week's podcast is an edited version of my talk. As you listen, take time to reflect on some of the things that have become part of your own leadership journey. Here are a few things to think about. What have been some of the key stages in your journey? Who have been the major influencers? What defining moments have shaped you? How would you describe your sense of calling or vocation? Enjoy the podcast. What I want to do this morning is talk to you about the story of Moses. The thing's been advertised as finding yourself in your own story. But I want to do that from the story of Moses. Obviously, Moses is a massive character in terms of the biblical story. He's the lawgiver. He's the person who leads the people of Israel in the Exodus from Egypt. A hugely theologically significant figure in the world of the Bible. But the way I want to read his story is a little bit more, to read his story is a little bit more of a paradigm, and to reflect on some of the things that shaped him. And as we reflect on some of the things that shaped Moses across the whole of his 120-year journey, then I want each of us to have the opportunity to reflect on our own stories. But I actually want to begin by quoting or reading a little bit to you from William Shakespeare, the playwright, who said this: "All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages." And he goes on to talk about the seven ages of a man, beginning with infancy, all the way through to second childishness, what he calls second childishness. And he describes it very graphically. He talks about it being a time of oblivion, where teeth are gone and where taste is gone. It's not really a very appetizing or very encouraging picture. But that's one way that people down through history have tried to think about life and the story of life and the different stages along which life evolves. You maybe have heard that it was said by D.L. Moody, the American evangelist, that Moses spent 40 years thinking he was somebody, 40 years learning he was nobody, and 40 years discovering what God can do with a nobody. 40 years, 40 years, 40 years. 40 formative years, 40 wilderness years, and 40 leadership years where he's actually involved in doing his life work. Gordon MacDonald talks about the questions that people ask during each decade. So in the teenage years, the questions are questions of identity, he says. Questions like, who am I? Who am I becoming? We move into the 20s and we've got questions of goals, questions of place, questions of community. In other words, what am I going to do with my life? Who am I going to do this with? In our 30s, questions of order and impact. How do I manage my responsibilities? So in our 30s, questions like, how do I manage my responsibilities? How do I keep renewed? In our 40s, probably a number of you in your 40s, probably some in your 30s, I would think, number in your 40s, questions of uncertainty. How do I feel about the person that I have become? Because once you're in your 40s, especially as you push on into your 40s, you realise that there's a fair bit of life that's now behind you and a fair bit of shaping that's taken place. So there are these questions of uncertainty. Into the 50s, what is my vision? Martin's taken notes and Doug. What is my vision for the second half? Have I reached a ceiling? Questions of change and questions of intentionality. Into the 60s, which is pertinent for a number of us, what does a person of my age bring to the table? Is there still a place for me at the table? 70s, how do I handle the sense of loss, because in the 70s there's increasingly a sense of loss, loss of relationships, loss of work, loss of abilities to do things. And he calls these questions of grieving and rearranging the 80s. What can I offer a world that sees me as feeble and obsolete? What does it mean to live with obscurity? And in the 90s, if we make it that far, how do I deal with end-of-life issues? What is my legacy? How will I die? Who will remember me? All kinds of questions that occur at different points of life. Now, the Moses template that I'm suggesting for us this morning is a much simpler template. And it's Stephen, in his sermon in the book of Acts, who draws particular attention to the three periods of 40 years that Moses lives. And I've described those as, first of all, the formative years, year 0 to year 40. These are the years that he lives at home with his mother, lives in the palace in Egypt as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. That then transitions very dramatically at age 40 to the middle phase of his life, which I call the wilderness years or the exile years, where he's living basically in obscurity in Midian. And then from age 80, and again there's a very dramatic turning point that moves him from stage 2 into stage 3, the final stage of his life is the leadership years, where he's leading this fledgling nation of Israel out of Egypt and through the desert. That's the broad picture that we want to think about this morning. And I just want to dip into each of these in a little way. And already I want you to be thinking about stages of your life. Sometimes the stages of our life are marked out by the fact that we live in one place before we move to another place. Or it's marked out because one stage is all about education, next stage is about training, next stage is about work. Or it may be marked out because of the state of family, singleness, marriage, children, grandchildren, whatever it might be. There are different ways that we can mark out the stages of our lives. We may be in different places, we're doing different things, different things are happening around us. But be thinking about that, the stages of your own life. It may not be as simple as Moses and just the three. You may have a lot more than that, but be thinking of those. So the first stage is the formative years of his life. And these first years of his life are years of that I would describe as years of influence and choices. Influence and choices. I have a friend back in Northern Ireland. His name is Colin Neal. Colin has a day job where he works with an organisation called Invest NI. It's got to do with helping to promote business in Northern Ireland. But he's also a very good writer, and he's a very deep thinker in terms of his Christian faith. A number of years ago, he wrote a book which he called Tuaras. You need to know a little bit about the background of Ireland to really read Tuaras and fully understand it. But basically, he wrote this book several years ago, and basically he's projecting the year 2020 in Ireland. And Ireland has been reunited. So almost 100 years after the partition of Ireland, he's imagining an Ireland that's been reunited. The Pope's coming to visit, and a man called Gerry Adams is apparently going to be the president. That's how he's imagining this. And the story settles. The story focuses on a group of men in a church who are they're in a Bible study group, men's Bible study group, like probably some of you are in, and they're grappling with these massive changes that have come into their world. They're Presbyterians, and therefore the changes are really massive for them in this idea of the reunification of Ireland. But at the beginning of the book, one of the characters says this, the narrator character says, "I never fail to marvel at how much of a person's character and experience often seems the consequence of a random chance of birth. I never fail to marvel at how much of a person's character and experience often seems the consequence of a random chance of birth." When you think about your own life, nobody asked you at what point in history you wanted to be born. It wasn't that you were queued up somewhere and, you know, the offers were, anybody, you know, want to be born in the middle of the 20th century? Anybody want to be born at the end of the 20th century? Anybody like to be born in the 17th century, maybe as an alternative? Nobody asked you that. Nor were you asked which family you would like to be born into or which part of the world you would like to be born into. And yet when you think about that, those three factors, when you were born, where you were born, and to whom you were born, have had massive impact on the person that you have become. And yet you had absolutely nothing to do with any of that. And you see it in the story of Moses, don't you? He's born at this very particular point in the history of God's people. It's generations after the time of Joseph. Joseph, who was a great benefactor to the Egyptians, had been forgotten. And the descendants of the Israelite patriarchs who were living in Egypt had multiplied to the point that they were a threat to the Egyptians. Now, they were useful because they could work, but they were also a threat because there were just too many of them. And so you have the openings of Exodus have this situation where you have Pharaoh trying to deal with this problem of the Israelites. And you've got what effectively is a kind of an ethnically based infanticide policy that's happening. There are several aspects to it. But at the time that Moses is born, the ruling is that if a Hebrew mother gives birth to a son, he needs to be exposed in the river. So Moses is born at that particular time. I guess in the scheme of things, not a particular time that you'd really want to be born at. And certainly if you're going to be born then, you'd probably choose to be born as an Egyptian rather than born into the Hebrews. And yet he's born to the Hebrews. He's born at that particular time. He's born in Egypt. But yet he's born to a family of faith. And it's interesting that when he's born, his mother looks at him. Chapter 2, verse 2 says, she conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months. Now, I think pretty much every mother looks at their firstborn, well, not that he was their firstborn, but looks at her son and says, of course he's a fine child. But this is highlighted in the text. And when you come to Hebrews chapter 11, the writer of that letter to the Hebrews says, by faith, this woman and her husband made a decision not to fear the king, but actually to defy the king's edict. So you realize that for all the negativity about the circumstances and the timing of Moses' birth, he's born into a family of faith. And his mother actually becomes the first of several women that God uses to preserve the life of Moses. She preserves his life by defying the king. You run the story on a little bit. And there he is, you know, in his little boat thing, and he's bobbing around in the water. And along comes Pharaoh's daughter. And rather than saying, oh, a Hebrew, I'd better tell my dad about this one, or I'll just finish off what should have happened, she takes pity on him. And she saves his life. And then the sister Miriam, who's standing nearby, she comes up with a great idea. Would you like me to find one of the Hebrew women to look after him for you? Well, yes, of course, that'd be a great idea. So in the end, Moses gets brought up by his own mother, who's paid by the princess for doing so. And there's a tremendous irony in that story, isn't there? And of course, there's a level of irony in that where you look at Pharaoh and he's saying, I've got a problem with these Hebrews. And my problem with these Hebrews, I can solve the problem with these Hebrews if I deal with the males. Moses becomes his nemesis. And humanly speaking, the reason Moses becomes his nemesis is because of 3 women. And it's almost as though God is laying down this principle that he will work through the unexpected and the surprising. You know, when we're looking and expecting this is where the action is, God is actually doing something somewhere else. There's more that could be said about that, but I want you to notice this sense of influence. People who made decisions that ended up shaping the life of Moses. If those women hadn't made those decisions, well, Moses' life would have ended. But people made decisions that shaped his life. Now, you begin to think about yourself, think about your own story. Not only are you thinking about some of the stages of your life, but think about some of the influencers. None of us has got to where we are today without the influence of other people along the way. For some of us, it's parents. For others of us, maybe it's a youth leader. Professionally, maybe it's a teacher or a mentor. None of us has got to where we have without the influence of other people. I was talking about some of this material a few years ago with a group in Belfast, and someone told me a story which has stuck with me, and I've often told it subsequently. And it's a story about a man who was a minister of a church in Northern Ireland, and he one day was visiting the area of Belfast where he'd grown up, and he saw an elderly man whom he recognised as his old Sunday school teacher. He went over and introduced himself. Oh, my name is Billy Thompson, and I want you to know that, you know, I was in your Sunday school class, and I want you to know that you know, in the course of time I came to faith in Christ, and also want you to know that I'm serving God today as a minister of a church. And this old man reached into his inside pocket of his overcoat and took out a little notebook and a pencil, opened it, and there was a list of names, including Billy Thompson's name. He put a little tick beside it. And obviously there was a man who had not only taught his boys in Sunday school, but he kept an interest and he kept praying for them. And as he found out, you know, how God had answered his prayers down through the years, a little tick. And some of us maybe have got characters like that in our past. It's worth, I think, reflecting on it. You know, we can, sometimes it's only in pausing and reflecting that we realise those kinds of influences. They're there in our own lives. And many people who go on to, even to positions of significant leadership, they find as they look back, they see those kind of figures who have influenced them. I have a very good friend back in Ireland who's a retired bishop. He would call himself a refired bishop. He doesn't really believe in retirement. He believes in refirement. He actually got little badges, stickers printed. So if he finds anybody who's over 65, he gives them a sticker that talks about being refired. But he told me that he had had a very godly teacher in school, secondary school, that was an English teacher, I think. And this man had a huge influence on my friend and on a lot of other people. And some 50 years after my friend, who's called Ken, had left school, he realized that this teacher had prayed for him regularly and consistently for 50 years. I don't know if you've got people like that in your life. I don't know if you are that kind of person. But those formative stages of life are often comprised with influences, the influences of other people. Much of what I've said about that has to do with things that were outside of Moses' own control. But there comes a point when whatever influences that we've got, and whether it's the difficult circumstances that Moses lived through, was born into, whether it's the positive influences that he had because of the family that he was born into, there eventually comes a point when Moses has to make his own mind up. And that comes about in the incident where it's at the tail end of chapter 2, where he sees a Hebrew who's being oppressed by one of the Egyptians. He kills the Egyptian. He thinks nobody sees him. The next day, there are two Hebrews who are fighting, and he goes out to sort them out. Turns out that, well, the word was out. Somebody had seen him. When you think about it, it's quite obvious who had seen him. Because he obviously rescued a Hebrew from an Egyptian. So the Hebrew lived to tell the tale and presumably had told the tale. So word spreads. So the next day he's trying to sort out these two Hebrews. And he discovers what I think church leaders sometimes discover this when they arrive in new churches. New leaders arrive in new churches. They discover this, that they walk in thinking, well, I'm here to sort you all out, and you'll all be glad that I'm here. I'm your God-ordained leader. And of course they turned to Moses and they said, who made you a king or a ruler and a judge over us? And I think a lot of church leaders have probably experienced that at various times in their ministry. But he then has to escape. And it's a bit of a mess, really. And you debate, you know, did he do the wrong thing? Was it the right thing but the wrong time? You know, there are all kinds of questions that it raises. The reality is that he goes from a moment where he thought, this is the beginning of my leadership of this people. I'm going to be their liberator, the freedom fighter. He goes from that to spending the next 40 years in obscurity. So it's a mess and it's very disappointing. But on the positive side, what you see is that Moses has put down a marker He has decided who he is. He's a Hebrew, he's not an Egyptian. And he's decided where the future lies. The future lies with this people of God, even though they may be slaves at the moment. This is where God's future is. He somehow grasped that by faith and chose to suffer with them rather than to enjoy life with the Egyptians. And just as we can think about the circumstances of our lives and we can think about the influencers in our lives, I think also we get moments where we've got to say, well, who am I and what really matters? Where does the future lie? Some of you have maybe had to make professional decisions. And you'll know there'll be all kinds of factors around those professional decisions. A lot of people will say, well, you want this one because it's got the best opportunity for professional development, or you want this one because it's got the biggest salary, or the, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But how often do we make even professional decisions based on how we think God wants us to be and based on this sense of identity that I belong to God, and that is the most significant thing in the decisions that I make that shape my future? All of that is in the formative years. I need to move on to the exile years, because he's now been pitched into this middle phase of his life, which is wilderness or exile. Now, I would think that in the providence of God, the 40 years that he spends in the desert become part of essential training for his leadership years, because he's going to have to lead these people around the desert for 40 years. But he's going to have to spend those 40 years in the desert. And, you know, a guy who's grown up in the palace is maybe not terribly skilled at knowing, you know, where do you find water in the desert? How do you identify what snakes are safe and what snakes are unsafe? You know, there's kind of wilderness survival skills that you need to learn. And living as a shepherd for 40 years in the desert, he probably had lots of things to learn. I've thought a lot about this middle 40 years of his life. In terms of the narrative in the text, there's really not very much about it. It's treated very, very quickly. And yet, to me, it seems that the lessons of this phase of Moses' life are far more significant. They're more far-reaching than the small amount of space that's given to them in the text. And part of what makes me say that is when you look at Moses at 40 and Moses at 80, he's very different. I suppose most of us would be very different if we survived till 80, if you were to compare what we were at 40. That's probably the way life works. There are individuals like Caleb, you know, who manages to get into his 80s, and he's just as strong and just as visionary as he was when he was 40. But, you know, there's probably an inevitable slowing down that comes. But with Moses, there's a profound change that happens. You've got someone at 40 who has this vision for his life, and his vision for his life is to be the liberator and the ruler of the Egyptians. He actually, or of the Hebrews. He thought the Hebrews would recognize that. When he eventually is given the opportunity to lead at age 80, he says, God, anything but. So in fact, I've been quite happy here the past number of years, just wandering around the desert looking after sheep. So if you can possibly find somebody else to do that leadership thing, I'm happy with the sheep. And of course, as we'll see in a moment or two, God doesn't leave him at that. But to me, there's that profound change that happens there. It's the loss of a vision. It's disillusionment. Even though we may not have been in a, whether or not we've been in a literal desert, I think sometimes we can have a sense that life feels a little bit like a wilderness or an exile. There's a little book by a guy called Paul Miller called A Praying Life. And I'm indebted to that book for this little picture that I want to create for you. If you think about a stage of life where you've had great aspirations and ambitions, a great sense of vision, and you project forward to the reality of where you are, and it's very different. That gap, in some ways, is the wilderness. It's how Paul Miller describes it. That's the wilderness. Moses found himself in the wilderness, and it was a place of unexpected circumstance. He did not expect to be there. If you'd met him at 40, You know, his 40th birthday. So Moses, any big plans for the next decade? Yeah, you know, God willing, I'm going to be the leader of this people. And you meet him at 50 or 60, and it's completely different. He's gone from being in this center of civilization in Egypt to being obscurity in the desert. He's gone from this place of sophistication to looking after sheep. And looking after sheep was actually unclean, regarded as unclean by the Egyptians. Place of unexpected circumstances. And I think it can happen to all of us, can't it? Sometimes in a major way, sometimes in less significant ways. But you may be able to identify with some of that. Wilderness years. And a sense of, do you know, this is not really where I expected to be at this particular stage of my life. And the wilderness becomes a place where the dream that Moses has is actually stripped away. You kind of wonder about the confusion that he must have experienced as he's sort of sitting at the well at the beginning of these exile years, sitting at the well where he meets his future wife. But when all of that is going on, you know, what am I doing here? What happened? Why did God not stand by me? And there he is in this place of unexpected circumstances that becomes a place of abandoned dreams. There's a fascinating book by Dan Allender called Leading with a Limp. Any of you interested in Christian leadership? Fascinating book and a kind of quite counterintuitive book in many ways. Talks about challenges that leaders face. And he makes this observation in there, reflecting on the story of Moses. A leader's dreams must die if a deep soul is to be born. Idealism may get us into the fray, but it is the loss of all we cherish that begins to form in us a heart capable of leading others reluctantly and humbly. You know, that suggestion that actually it's all very well for you, as you know, if you're involved in leadership, for you to think, you know, here's my vision, let's just get up there, proclaim the vision, and let's go for it. And Dan Allender says, well, actually, very often what has to happen is that you've got to lose that so that God can give you his vision. And this stripping process for Moses is very radical, such that when he gets to age 80, he really just doesn't want to know about it. So there's another area of reflection. It's a painful area of reflection. I think one of the things that happens in it is there's a call for honest realization. It's an interesting little footnote. He names one of his sons Gershom, which sounds like the Hebrew for a sojourner. And Moses is saying, well, I don't really belong here. And he certainly was speaking the truth. Where did he belong? The Hebrews didn't want him. He couldn't go back to the Egyptians. And he didn't really belong in Midian. And in naming his son, he names the reality of his existence. And sometimes that's what we've got to do when we find ourselves in wilderness. I remember meeting a guy, Paulie and I bumped into this guy that we know several years ago. He was in a Christian bookshop. And at the time he was working in a church. And we were chatting with him, and we picked up a real sense of disappointment from him. People didn't fully appreciate him. You know, he did all these things, and the families didn't really appreciate what he did for their kids and so on. And yet the odd thing about the conversation was he would punctuate it with a little phrase. Every now and again he would say, it's all good. And you're left thinking, well, that really is not what it sounds like. So why would you say it's all good? And I can't help thinking that there's maybe a bit of an element of denial. And sometimes, you know, for us as Christians, we find ourselves in difficult situations, but we sort of feel obliged to say to people it's all good, whether we think it's the spiritual answer or whether we just don't want to let on that not everything is all good because we think that it's all good for everybody else. But the desert, for all of its pain, for all of its stripping, for all of its sense of disillusionment, I think if it's to become a place of hope, it needs to be a place of honest admission and honest realization. He meets God on the edge of the desert, and that becomes the second major turning point of his life. As you think about your life, you think about your own story, think about major turning points. And this major turning point is the experience where he encounters God in this bush that is burning but is not consumed. And this pitches him into the leadership years. But before we get into the leadership years, it's worth thinking about what happens in terms of this this issue of his argument with God. Interesting thing, just by the way, in terms of leadership, I read this in a journal that actually written by a couple of guys from IMD, so not very far away from here. One of them is a fellow called Shlomo Ben-Hur. And he wrote a paper that actually looked at the story of Moses. And he says this, he says, in reading this, the story of Moses, one is reminded that much of so-called leadership stems from ambition. But when ambition is the motivating factor, the leader is not a true leader, but a commander. It's this idea of reluctant leaders and reluctant leadership. And recently, I read an article, it was actually an editorial in the Times newspaper, that suggested that the problem, the reason why we've so much bad leadership in the world, and we do, you know, politically and all kinds of ways, the problem, he says, this guy called Sam Walker, writing the column, said, is the problem with bad leadership that too many bad leaders put themselves forward? He said, we fail to appreciate that one of the key leadership traits is genuine reluctance to take the job. Now, you may want to kick that one around. I think it's fascinating. One of the key leadership traits is genuine reluctance to take the job. So somebody who's always saying, pick me, you know, push it to the front of the queue, maybe that's not the person you should pick. Something that's worth thinking about. But here's this reluctant leader, and he now finds himself in an encounter with God, making excuses. And his excuses really range around several questions. The first question is, who am I? God says, well, this is what I want you to do. Moses says, well, who am I that I would do that? Now, who am I can be a fair enough question. And we can say, I feel overwhelmed at what you're asking me to do. Who am I to do this? But here it's a bit of an excuse. And I find it's interesting that God answers Moses by saying, he doesn't really answer the question who Moses is. He says, I'll be with you. In other words, who you are, who you think you are, is less important than the fact that God is with you and who he is. Which leads Moses to his second question. Who am I? Well, who are you? So if you're going to be with me, well, who are you anyway? And if I go down and talk to these people and they say, well, who has sent you? Well, what am I going to tell them? And God gives them this mysterious name. I am who I am. I will be who I will be. God is self-sufficient. Doesn't need to define himself on the basis of anybody else or anything else. He is and he will be who he will be. And then Moses goes on and says, okay, well, that's fine, but what if they won't listen? And I have a bit of sympathy with Moses in this regard, because he could say, you know, 40 years ago I tried this thing and it didn't work, and you're asking me to do the same thing again. What if they don't listen to me this time either? That's not an unreasonable question. And sometimes we find that we're nervous about attempting something or taking a step. And the reason we're nervous is because of the painful memory of something that's happened to us before. And maybe there's an element of that that's lingering with Moses. God gives him signs, his staff, which is transformed, and a couple of other signs as well. And then he says, well, I don't know how to speak. And you think, well, that seems slightly odd, because you're standing here having a, you know, going toe-to-toe with the Lord, and everything he says to you, you're arguing back. Sounds like you're actually pretty good at speaking, pretty good at arguing. But maybe he's reflecting on his sense of inadequacy. He spent years being a sheep farmer. I don't know what language the sheep speak, but I would imagine that you don't need to be terribly, eloquent in order to speak to them. And it's far removed from the eloquence of the society in which he'd grown up. He's going to have to go and speak to the king of Egypt. A sheep farmer? Go and speak to the king of Egypt? I don't know how to speak. And eventually he says, please send someone else. At which point God starts to get somewhat angry with Moses. Gives him Aaron, his brother, to come alongside and be his helper. But he doesn't let Moses off the hook. Now, there's a lot more we could reflect on in relation to those excuses that Moses keeps bringing up. But I want us to think for a moment about our sense of calling or our sense of vocation. Because what's happening here is that Moses is now about to be launched out into the 40 years of his life, where he's going to do His major life work, in terms of the far-reaching consequences of it, he's going to become the lawgiver. He's going to become the liberator. He's going to become the legislator, and all of those things, the leader. Those all began with L, didn't they? He's going to become all of those things. That's going to be his life work. And he has this remarkable calling or commissioning that happens before he starts it. Now, I don't think we can expect that, you know, in everything we do, we're going to have some kind of experience like that, or even an Isaiah experience in the temple, or a Saul Paul experience on the road to Damascus. And I think as well that we've probably tended, I think much of the church has tended to say, well, if anybody has a sense of calling, it's going to be people like Martin or others who, you know, work for the church or go as missionaries or something like that. But for the rest of us, we just sort of get on with life. And we maybe don't always have an adequate sense of where God might be involved in our what we see as our ordinary life. Oz Guinness says this about calling. He says, calling is the truth that God calls us to himself so decisively that everything we are, everything we do, and everything we have is invested with a special devotion and dynamism lived out as a response to his summons and service. Everything we are, everything we do, everything we have is invested with a special devotion and dynamism lived out as a response to his summons and service. Now, that's an all-encompassing definition of calling. It doesn't leave any of us out. Because if we have been called as Christian men to belong to God, then all that we have and all that we are, all of our gifts, all of our talents, all of the opportunities, well, in some way, it's how we live and how we handle all of those things has to do with our response to this reality that we belong to God. So that gives all of us a challenge then, doesn't it? As you've thought about maybe formative years, maybe thought about a phase of exile, and as you think about the sense of calling into these active years for Moses, the leadership years for Moses, not necessarily going to be the leadership years for all of us, but into these active years, as you think about that, then it raises the question of, well, what are you doing with your life? I love a couple of things that Parker Palmer talks about in relation to calling or vocation. He's written a little book called Let Your Life Speak. You may not agree with everything that Parker Palmer says in there, but he's got some interesting things to say about vocation. And for him, vocation he's a Quaker, and for him, vocation is a sense of letting your life speak, of growing into our own authentic selfhood. And you think about it, you know, God has made you and God has given you certain gifts. You've gone through certain experiences. You are a particular person. And he would say that actually vocation is figuring out who you are. And he notes that very famous quotation from Frederick Buchner, who says that vocation is the place where your deep gladness meets the world's deep need. You know, we can do all kinds of things to try to meet the world's deep need, but where it doesn't intersect with our deep gladness, well, we're maybe doing duty. It's maybe not a sense of vocation. Similarly, we can be in full pursuit of our deep gladness without ever caring about the deep need of the world. And I think that can very easily evolve into a form of narcissism and selfishness. But where the two intersect, there's that sense of calling. And I love this expression. This is back to Parker Palmer. He says, vocation at its deepest level is, this is something I can't not do. Something I can't not do. For reasons I'm unable to explain to anyone else and don't fully understand myself, but that are nonetheless compelling. And so Moses then is pitched into this phase of leadership. There's a lot to be said about the challenges of leadership, the privileges of leadership that come out in all of this. He's pitched into that. There's the sense of responsibility that he has, the criticism that he has to deal with, which oftentimes he deals with really well. And I think you see Moses at his finest in his story when God is saying to him on two occasions, Moses, just stand out of the road and I'll destroy these people and I'll start again with you. And Moses says, God, don't do it, because if you do that, all the peoples around are going to say you weren't able to look after your own people. He's more concerned about the glory of God than he is about his own comfort. And I think that's Moses at his highest. Moses at his lowest is where he's challenged just one time too many by the people. Speak to the rock, God says to him, and water will come out. And Moses stands up and angrily says, you rebels, must we bring water out of this rock? He takes the staff and he strikes the rock. The water still comes out. But Moses has stepped across a line where he has made this more about himself than about God. He has not honored God as holy. And so he forfeits his place in the land of promise. The challenge, the pressure, the responsibility, the criticism, the intercession, all of those things that you see in his story. I think, and I want to say this, I hadn't necessarily planned to say this ahead of time, but I think I've had a couple of conversations this morning that make me want to just flag this. One of the marks of Moses' leadership is the fact that he prepared the next generation. There's a tremendous contrast between the end of Moses' leadership and the end of Joshua's leadership. The end of Moses' leadership, Moses realizes, I'm not going to be able to finish the task. And therefore, we need God to raise somebody up. He doesn't sulk in a corner and say, well, you know, God, if you're not going to let me go into the land of promise, you can sort it out yourself. He prays that God will raise up someone. And it turns out it's Joshua, his young assistant, who's been with him all these years. And he prays for Joshua. And Joshua becomes the appointed leader who completes what Moses is unable to do. And Joshua leads successfully the conquest, the division of the land, and so on. And yet when Joshua comes to the end of his leadership, you get the book of Judges, which is chaos, one of the low points of the Old Testament. Chaos. There's no succession. And, you know, I think as we get older, and, you know, a number of you are sort of similar generation to me, but as we get older, we need to realize that the work that we are involved in, and particularly the areas of ministries that we might have, ways that we serve God, as we are getting older, we need to realize that God's work and God's mission in this world is going to last longer than us. Therefore, I think there increasingly comes a point as we get older where we need to be looking forward to the next generation and even the generation beyond that, and seeing what we need to be doing so that the work will continue. I have a friend who was at a retreat of pastors not that long ago, and they were sharing their vision for their church's vision for the future. And I think some of them were sharing 5-year vision or 10-year, maybe something like that, and feeling quite pleased about it, until someone in the group came along and said, well, our church has got a vision for the next 100 years. You look at that and think, wow, how could anybody possibly have a vision for 100 years? But you see the point. It's a vision that's far beyond this. Let's just not get through to 2020 or 2025. But what's it going to look like in several generations in the future? What's being put down now to prepare for those times in the will of God well into the future? Moses, I think, gives us some sort of a model, at least partially, how to deal with that. But here's the final thing, I want to finish with this. There is a crisis that Moses has in Exodus chapter 33. And God is threatening not actually to go with the people. And Moses says, well, you know, we need you to come with us. If you don't come with us, well, don't send us. And God allows Moses to have a very special vision of his glory. He hides him in a cleft in the rock, and gives him this special vision of his glory. And God honored Moses, described him as faithful in the face of the challenges that he experienced. And here's what he said. He said at that particular incident in Exodus 33, you have found favor in my sight, and I know you by name. That is the highest privilege of what it means to live our lives with God, isn't it? You know, we may be called to amazing opportunities and amazing achievements, whether it's in church ministry, whether it's in some other sphere of our profession, whether it's in a sphere of research or development or whatever it might be. We can be called to some amazing highs. But our anchor point is, and if it's true for Moses, how true it is for us in the gospel through Jesus, to hear God say, "You found favor in my sight, and I know you by name." I think it's Henry Nouwen who says that we need to learn to listen for the voice that calls us the beloved. It's our anchor in life. And I think about Jesus in Luke chapter 10, where he sends out a whole squad of his disciples. They go out on mission, and it's fantastic. You know, demons are driven out, and all kinds of amazing things are happening. And they come back, and they're so full of excitement, and Jesus says, "Do you know, I saw Satan thrown out of heaven?" And he says, that's wonderful, all those things that were happening. He says, don't rejoice in this. Don't rejoice in that, but rejoice in this. Not that the spirits are subject to you, but rejoice that your names are written in heaven. And you see, that means then that if your life is spectacular, well, you're anchored by the fact that the most important thing is God saying, "You found favor in my sight, I know you by name." If your life doesn't feel very spectacular, if it feels very ordinary, it's elevated, isn't it? By this realization, "You found favor in my sight, and I know you by name." And that's what gives us the anchor, whatever stage we're at. Whether it's those formative years of shaping, whether it's the wilderness years of doubting and questioning, or whether it's the ministry years, the leadership years, years of calling and living out our calling and living out our vocation, that in all of it we learn to listen for the voice that calls us the beloved. Thanks for taking the time to listen to this week's podcast. I hope it's been helpful. Remember that you can subscribe to the podcast for free on iTunes or Castbox, and it would be great if you were able to take a couple of minutes to leave a review. The podcast will be back next week, so be sure to join us, and in the meantime, have a good week.